There was one decision made at Cabinet this week which went a little bit under the radar because we're not going to be seeing the fruits of it for a little while yet, but it could be a fairly radical change in how Ireland goes about its business, particularly when it comes to meeting its climate ambitions. Government this week signed off on the heads of the Climate Action Bill, which was one of the major promises in the programme for government to be published within 100 days of the new government taking office. But what sort of impact is it going to have? What is it going to mean? And is it going to mean that the government will now be formally setting itself fairly ambitious targets for meeting Ireland's climate ambitions, and exactly how is it all going to be met? Well, we're joined on the line now by the Minister for Climate Action and Transport, Eamon Ryan. Minister, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Gavin.
Explain to us exactly what the Climate Action Bill contains and when we're going to see it.
We'll see it introduced in the next 2 weeks. I hope to have it agreed through the Oireachtas before Christmas and before, in time for the fifth anniversary of the Paris Climate Agreement. People will remember that 5 years ago where every country in the world sat down to say we will try and keep temperature increases, try and stop the rise being more than 1.5 degrees. To achieve that, we each have to set out a plan and how we will effectively stop using any fossil fuels and go carbon neutral as a country by the middle of this century, by 2050. And the government has committed in the next decade to do 7% per annum reductions to set us on that path. What this bill will do will set out the way we will do that. It strengthens an existing provision where we have a climate advisory council. That council will advise government and help in terms of looking to see what sort of speed, what areas should we be able to cut emissions. It will allow the government then work with the Oireachtas. What's worked in this, in my mind, is that it works best when there's political cooperation, when all parties see this as the way we need to go, because in truth, it's going to take 2, 3, 4, 5 governments in a row to deliver it. So we will sit down with the other parties, and it sets out the mechanisms for doing that, and between government departments, to set out 3 5-year plans. With setting out what are the changes we make in transport, in energy, in agriculture, in industry, in all these different areas.
So is it then intended that this bill will actually set out what the actions will be, or is it just more a way that you lay the framework to decide the actions later?
It's the latter. It sets out how you do it. It won't actually put in place all the different measures. A lot of those measures were already agreed on. We're going to switch to renewable power. We're going to make our homes much more energy efficient, and that'll be much healthier, better homes to live in, and in that way also get rid of fuel poverty. We will change in transport. We'll be changing towards supporting much more active travel modes, walking and cycling and public transport, but also designing our communities, new communities where you have a strong sense of local connection, where this idea of a 15-minute city, or putting towns and villages first, where people have services close to where they're living, that's a critical part of the switch. And I suppose also critically, it'll involve the introduction of a new land use plan. So we start managing a farming that, first of all, protects the Irish family farm, but also make sure that we're paying our farmers properly. And at the same time, we're storing carbon in our soils through forestry, through managing our peatlands. We are protecting biodiversity at the same time, because we address the biodiversity and the climate crisis at the same time. This bill will set out the path for all these various different measures if we have to government to then deliver them. But having the right path is a critical part of it.
I understand that it's going to provide for carbon budgets, and they're going to be, do I understand it right, that they're going to be a 5-year project, so that it would provide for the government setting out a carbon budget which would then prevail for the following 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's not budget, maybe in the sense people think of just about the spending money, although that is a critical part of it. But it's also just recognising what are the limits, what's the amount of reductions, or what's the ambition for reductions in each sector. And if we don't meet them, then to adjust the plans so that we get back on track. So it's basically planning so that we don't put this off forever and a day, but we can do it in an ordered, organised way, so that people know what's coming. And we can adjust as we go.
When would we envisage having the first of those 5-year budgets then, if this is enacted before Christmas?
It'll be next year. And to be honest, it'll be the latter part of next year, because it'll take us a year, that consultation with other parties, working with other departments, and also working with local communities. This will work best when it's bottom up as well. So we have to make sure that local authorities can help deliver it. We have to make sure that local communities are bought in. that is seen, this has to work. This will only work if it leads to a better economy. So this will only work if it actually leads to us, it helps us get out of the economic difficulties we're in. So that's what we'll do. We'll pass this legislation this autumn. It's in tune with what the European Union is doing, because Europe is saying the recovery has to be green. Europe is saying we'll provide a fund, this recovery fund, and 37% of the funding will be for climate action. So we as a country will go to that with our sort of ideas. And then next year, we can start spending some of that money, but also start planning the more those 3-5-year plans.
Okay. But what does a carbon budget day look like? Is it going to be a case where, you know, I know like a financial budget, for example, would be much more prescriptive around the measures. So would a carbon budget be like that? Would you be outlining that, you know, for example, your own Department of Transport will cut its emissions by 7% every year and how it's going to do that? Or will it be a bit more bare bones? Or what will it look like?
No, that has to be done in the annual budget, and the annual budget itself, the financial budget, has to start matching to what the climate budget is. So we have to start looking in every single aspect of making this change. But the climate budget or the climate bills budget are a more long-term process. It's more drawn out, bringing in expert advice and reviewing on over a lengthy period of time. It's not something which is just one day. Everything is decided, or everything set out.
So it's not going to be a process. It's not going to be prescriptive, but it would outline that the department has this amount of tons of carbon that it's allowed to emit, and that would reduce every year under
and
a kind of a plan.
And if you're not doing that, then you have to start changing your other policies, changing your other budgets to get you back on the right track.
Welcome as that would be, and obviously a lot of people would want the state to take more assertive action in managing carbon targets, and that's probably part of the reason why so many Green TDs were elected in February. But it strikes me that they might not have the flexibility that you needed to, because if you're outlining a 5-year carbon budget, and obviously you want to take corrective action somewhere along the way, but that it doesn't respond to, you know, the likes of the pandemic that has blown up in our faces in the last 8 months, where suddenly the way in which you manage carbon and some of the reliance that you have on public resources is completely changed. And it wouldn't seem to be flexible enough to deal with something like that, which might arise halfway along the term.
It shows the need for it, because we all know, you know, events happen and things change and priorities move. By having this approach, and we've seen other countries, the UK has done it and others have done it, it means that your consistency, even through kind of, you know, politics is, you know, turns to different issues at different times, but it keeps you on a set course. And of course, what we see is with the pandemic, I mean, in a sense, it's coming from an original route, which is us not managing or not looking after our relationship with nature, and nature kicks back in the end. So it is all connected. But also, the other aspect of this is the new economy. This is where any smart country looking to the future would want to be. And we have a real opportunity here in my mind. It's not always a burden that you have to adhere to something. It's actually where, as I said, investment will come. It will create better local environment for all of us. It will improve our health. So when you're taking the measures we want to make, it will not work if it's a punitive, thou shalt do this, thou shalt do that. It has to be something which actually creates a better local community, a better social economy. And it is where the new economy is going. So it's in our interest to keep focus on this. What the bill does and what the whole policy approach is that we don't get distracted, or we don't give up on the ambition. We put it at the centre stage of all government thinking and all agency thinking, and see it as the critical part of our economic development.
Can I ask you about the transport half of your brief? Because you mentioned a few weeks ago that you were looking at the idea of containing within the Living with COVID roadmap some sort of new regime that might allow for testing at airports, which could perhaps pave the way for a slightly more liberal air transport regime than we've seen for the last 6 or 7 months. It wasn't included in the Living with COVID roadmap, but where is that? Is there any development on the horizon for perhaps having quick turnaround tests in airports and how all of that might work?
Yeah, this is critical, and we've been looking at it consistently now for the last 3 months. It's not easy because the virus keeps changing, the level of transmission and so on. But we will, in the next 2 weeks, have a much more precise application of around air travel. We've started that process by saying we were buying into the approach that the European Commission has proposed, approach across Europe, and that makes sense. Because
this is to succeed the green list.
Yes, but that is just the first part of it. They also have an amber and red list, and we have to look at how we would apply that. Included in that is to look at how we would apply testing, and I think we should. I think it's complex, and I think it's not just that you'd immediately test every single person going through the airport. That wouldn't work, and you have to be careful that we don't take from the testing capacity we need in the state within our public health system. But our department has been looking and working with the Dublin Airport Authority and others, and the European Commission and others, to see what might work. Is there other testing capacity we can avail of which would be separately available? It's more likely it would apply where you would take a test a period of time before flying, because that is what the other countries are doing, and I think it meets some of the public health concerns that you're not missing people at the airport if you're trying to test everyone just at the airport. It would be reciprocal with other countries, and other countries are already looking for Irish people flying to provide tests because they see us and having a high level of incidence.
On just a practical level, we have to
manage the fact that we do want to maintain connectivity as an island, as a country with huge need for keeping in touch with the rest of the world. We do want to keep our air connectivity and our ferry connectivity. And as part of that, then, is providing this sort of management system.
I appreciate that we're getting into hypotheticals and that this hasn't been all set in stone yet, but how exactly might that look in practice? So say, for example, you want to fly to another country and you need to get tested 3 days before departure. Do you go to the airport? Do you go to your own GP? Or how exactly do you envisage all of that maybe working?
I think the private market, and including the airports and the airlines, we'll be well able to manage that as to whether, you know, where you go to get the test done. As I said, we don't want it interrupting or getting in the way of other public health testing, but we do need it because we do need a certain amount of, you know, there's certain business or other travel needs, personal travel needs that people do have to do. It'll depend on where the country is on that European list. And as I said, that the General Affairs Council on the 13th of October, the European Commission proposal is due to be hopefully signed off on. And we'll be part of that. And even in advance of that, I hope that we'll have a clear roadmap agreed by government internally in terms of what sort of measures we'd apply, what sort of testing. It'll be limited in terms, it won't be, as I said, for every person flying, but we will need some, in my mind. I think it's more likely to be in advance rather than at the airport. And I would like to kind of listen, we're listening to the public health advice on this. If you do have applications where you get a second test, if someone's coming back with one, that may give a lot of the protection that I think the public health advisors want in terms of not just relying on one single test. So it's those details we will agree in the next 2 weeks.
You can understand why people would be so keen to have that new regime and to have some sort of airport testing system in place, because the new green list that takes effect from midnight tonight is fairly pitiful. There's only four countries on it. One of them is Liechtenstein, which doesn't have an airport. And the other three countries that are on it are Finland, Cyprus and Latvia, all of whom have some sort of entry requirement or testing requirement for Irish visitors. So it does sort of mean that for recreational purposes, at least, you know, international travel is pretty much off the cards entirely, isn't it?
It is, and that's why we need to look at the amber and red lists and how we manage those. And this applied not just to European Union countries, but to the UK, US and other countries as well. So that sort of standardised approach for all travel is what we need. We do have to be careful of, you know, that if there are areas, people coming in from very high instance areas, we do have to be careful. But at the same time, we cannot shut down the country. We will need air travel, and it's a matter of regulating that, like everything else, is what we need to do to manage the COVID rather than trying to. It's not going to go in the next 6 months, in all likelihood. Therefore, we have to manage how we do air travel at the same time.
Just by the by, because I'm sure people will be listening and they aren't quite clear on the spec of all of this, what is the difference between the amber and the red? Is amber a country that you would be able to travel to once you've proven that you've tested negative, and then red is just a do not go at all?
They're the final details we have to agree with the European Commission. They've set out, and indeed other countries, they've set out various options in that regard, and government will have to choose between those options before we go to the General Affairs Council on the 13th.
One of your own party TDs, Nasa Hourigan, who's also the chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Budgetary Oversight, is in the Sunday Independent today calling for a restoration of the PUP to €350 a week. Obviously, we're now, unfortunately, in a world where more and more counties may be heading towards tighter restrictions, and that means more people who will be forced to give up the jobs that they had fought so hard to get back. Is there any scope to return PUP to €350 a week?
First, just one thing that has changed is that we've extended it. It's still open to applicants now to at least the end of the year, and that's being done at the same time that we see neighbouring and other countries pulling all or a lot of their kind of supports for workers and for people who've been affected. There is already $3.5 billion, I think, spent on it. It's more than we spend on child benefit in an ordinary year, and it's going to be extended into next year, not just to the end of this year. And we will have to keep reviewing it because we'll have to see what will happen in terms of the virus, whether, you know, how long it lasts into next year. So it is always kept under review. And I think that it's appropriate, including rates. But that's not the immediate challenge. I think here is actually manage the overall balance as we get our economy, get the numbers of COVID cases down, we get people back working, and I think, but at the same time, protect those who can't get their jobs back. Mm. And I think there's particular sectors. I mean, the pandemic unemployment payment is a universal social welfare payment. There may be sectors where we may have to do further other supports. It may not be the best way of doing that. It mightn't be to use social welfare payments, which by nature are universal. So I think the government, where there are particular areas of difficulty, and it's in areas like the hospitality sector, the arts, tourism, transport, people in aviation, they're the sectors that are worst hit. In terms of how you further protect them and help people in that area, one way you could do is, as was said, is kind of trying to raise the overall payments. But the other way would be to look at how do you support particular sectors, and that might have an advantage because they're the ones that are really hit.
So you might be looking at something perhaps maybe as soon as the budget in 2 weeks' time, something a little bit more targeted than the blanket nature of the PUP as it currently is.
And I think with this COVID, it isn't just the budget come and goes and that's it. Then I think there'll be an ongoing need to kind of review. We've seen, the various measures taken over the last few months, even the July economic stimulus and other measures. You have to keep adjusting because the effect of the virus on the economy keeps changing, and getting that balance right between protecting lives and protecting livelihoods means that we will need not just the budget this autumn, but we will need after it a economic recovery plan which looks at how we invest some of that European money I mentioned earlier, and indeed have a provision for further funding if we're going to need it next year. It will not be an ordinary budget year where you just on one day you set out, oh, here's the future for the next year, and then you don't come back to it. This is going to be an evolving process where we have to keep looking and keep looking at how we help and protect our most vulnerable in this process.
We mentioned that last Tuesday's cabinet meeting was the one where you signed off on the heads of the Climate Action Bill. It was also a meeting where you signed off on the appointment of 10 new special advisors for junior ministers. And I don't mean to prejudge whether they are good or bad value or the role that special advisors have, but did it cross anyone's mind at the table that it was a really bad look to hire 10 more ministerial advisors on the same day that PUP was being cut for 150,000 people?
Yeah, no, my colleague Catherine Martin, I think it's reported in one of the papers today in an accurate report, expressed a lot of concern about that timing, which was unfortunate. And we need advisors to make government work, in my mind. But that doesn't, you have to be sensitive to how that is presented.
So she did voice concerns, and yet the appointment still went ahead anyway.
Yes, because I suppose we also have the job we need to get on in government and delivering on the programme for government and working on this crisis and having an effective kind of government that works collectively with the public service and with others and internally was what was on our mind.
You can understand why it really sticks in people's craws, though, this idea that, because people don't understand the role that special advisors do. A lot of the time they're portrayed as being, political servants rather than public servants, and people just don't understand why you could sign off on 10 more advisors that cost $750,000 a year on the same day that you're cutting the welfare spend by such a huge amount.
Yeah, and I think that, as Catherine says, that sent out a really there was real difficulty in that. But the perspective was, okay, that decision had been made. Those advisors were ready to, or were there ready to start work. And I suppose first and foremost, what we need to do is do the work of government well. We have to make sure that we actually, the first responsibility is actually making the right decisions, making them quickly, getting the most out of our entire system. And while that communications is very unfortunate. The key task is actually getting government working. And that's what we decided
well,
to do.
If they are important then for the functioning of government, and this is the final question, Eamon, before I let you go, there are now seven junior ministers who don't have any advisers at all, and they would rightly feel that perhaps they are not getting any advisers because yourself and Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar have so many in government buildings all tied up to yourselves.
No, they're
being spread thinly because you have so many.
No, I said the advisers, first of all, in my own case, they're not actually... I've got two advisers and I have two government departments, and each of those are there to help me in running very large government departments. All the other people are working on actually across government, working on the programme for government to make sure that we deliver the promises that were made to the electorate. And actually that work is what's the most critical thing. It's the work that isn't just about working with one individual minister. It's about actually working for the people of Ireland collectively together, delivering a programme for government. That's how these people work. That's why these people work or how they work. And it's actually the delivery on the programme and delivery on the services for our people of what matters. That's what I'll be focused on. The advisor is only one part of that, but it's the delivery of services for our people is what really matters.
Minister for Climate Action and Environment, Eamon Ryan, thank you very much for joining us this lunchtime on The Record.